Now let's welcome our speaker, Lauren.
Hi, I'm Lauren. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Matt for asking me to speak. He sent me a text, "What are you doing Thursday?" And I'm thinking, Dodgers. You know, obviously, that was a little while ago. Anyway, outside issue. And I was like, I'm in town. And he said, "Don't talk about me. Thank you for agreeing to speak at the Brentwood Workshop." Anyway, not about you. Welcome to the newcomers. If you identified, and even if you didn't identify, it gets better, I promise. None of us would stick around if it didn't get better. This is the bottom. I was told to give it 90 days, to try to get to a meeting a day for 90 days, and if you don't like what we freely have to offer, we'll gladly refund your misery. And, you know, I mean, it is the bottom. I came in here, I'm fine, when people would ask how I was, but, I mean, it's Alcoholics Anonymous, this is the bottom. So nobody comes skipping in here because their life's great. And the first time I ever spoke, somebody needed somebody for a panel. They're going, "Hey, I need somebody." I didn't have quite enough time. I guess I was kind of close. I don't really remember how much time I had. And I thought my story was so boring, so I read the stories in the back of the big book looking for a good one. And so I just took like a little bit of this one, a little bit of that one. And so I went out on a panel, and I figured they're all new. They haven't read the big book either. So I told some of somebody's story, some of somebody else's. And then I went and did, I thought it was really fun. So I went and did another panel. After the third one, I told my sponsor what I was doing. She's like, "No, we tell our own story here." I was like, "Oh, okay." And I had no idea. And I thought my story was kind of boring. But then as I did my first step and started working the steps, I was like, "And more will be revealed," and peeling the onion. I was like, "All right, my story got a little bit better." But plus, I'm such a liar. I never knew what the truth was. And then the longer I'm sober and the more removed I get from my story, it doesn't even feel like mine anymore. It just feels like some person from a long time ago. And which it really is. I mean, anything you hear that's good, kind, and decent from me, it's learned behavior, and I learned it here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because the person that came in here is not the person that stands before you today. I'm a product of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been sober more than half my life, and you guys turned me into this. So I was taught to look for the similarities and not the differences. And one thing I related to from my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is I always felt different. I never felt like I fit in anywhere. And that's just something that I related to from the get-go. I'm from the East Coast, from Maryland, the D.C. area. And I know people here never care what state I say. I could say Pennsylvania. You guys all lump all the states together. But anyway. And what I always considered a typical middle-class Jewish neighborhood, I always thought I had the worst childhood ever. I played the victim. I hated my family. I thought I was probably secretly adopted, and I wanted another family to come and take me away from this family I was growing up with. And I really did. I thought I had the worst childhood ever until I heard your stories. I was like, okay, it wasn't that bad. And my parents were really into their social life. They were always going out. On weekends, my mom would get all dressed up. It was cocktail hour at 5 o'clock every night, and she would get all dressed up for my father. And it all looked glamorous, what they did. And they just never paid any attention to the kids at all. We could do whatever we wanted. They didn't pay any attention to it. They never looked at our report cards. They didn't look at anything. My mom went to one PTA meeting once, and she took me with her. And at the PTA meeting, they talked about the middle child syndrome, how the oldest gets all the attention, the oldest gets all the privileges, the youngest gets all the attention, so don't forget the middle child. And I thought, that's what's wrong with me. That's why I feel different. It's because I have the middle child syndrome. And until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, that's why I thought I felt different, because I'm the middle child. And today I know whenever I'm feeling different, not a part of, that I need to take an action. This is an action program. I need to do something. Even if it's just reaching out my hand, saying, "Hi, I'm Lauren," I feel weird. Because half the time I didn't know how I felt when I came in. And today it doesn't take me as long, but sometimes it takes me a while to process. But I need to do something, pick up the phone. It's better to talk to someone than text, I find, to actually have human interaction. But anyway, until I came in here, I just thought that's why I always felt different. And today I know it's my alcoholism, that I need to do something for it. The other thing, I heard somebody, I mean, I never heard anybody talking like I'm doing now. I mean, I never heard that growing up. Everything was fine, and what would the neighbors think? We weren't doing anything, but you always had to worry about what the neighbors thought. And, but I mean, I heard when I came in about, I heard somebody talking about being a liar, cheat, and a thief. I was like, yeah, that was me. My older sister, she was a classic overachiever. She did everything. She was in every club. She was a straight-A student. She was all that. That was not me. I was a bad kid acting out all the time. I would lie all the time. When I would hear Chapter 5 read in meetings, I thought, oh, my God, I'm never going to make it, because all I heard was honesty, 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 honesty. I thought, oh, my God, I'm never going to make it. I heard, how can you tell if an alcoholic's lying if they're moving their lips? It's like, yeah, that was me. And my father used to say, if you can't lie well, don't lie at all. And I took that as a challenge. And, I mean, I lied about everything as a kid. If I was going to 7-Eleven, I said I was going to my friend Helen's house. I just lied about everything. And I just wanted my parents to pay attention to me. I started cutting school early. I was the bad kid in my family. And I used to steal the money from my parents' bank on their nightstand and blame it on my little brother, who would never do that. And they have those senior superlatives in high school, the slickest skipper, I mean, you know, the best couple, most likely to succeed and all that stuff. I was voted most fried and slickest skipper in my high school graduating class. And I remember my mother saw that and said, what's most fried, Lauren? I'm like, never mind. And but I was a really social kid. I always had lots of little friends, but I never had that one best girlfriend, the one person that you can tell everything to. Because I knew if you knew me, and I mean really knew me, that you'd lock me up or throw me away. There was something wrong with me. I felt like everybody else knew how, was given some instruction manual or knew how to do everything, and I was just kind of a chameleon. Just, I'd watch and see how you did everything, and I'd fit in with this group or that group. I just never felt comfortable in my own skin. I didn't feel comfortable with my own family. We were never allowed in the living room. We weren't allowed in the kitchen because it was cocktail hour. We weren't allowed in my parents' bedroom. We were just not allowed, it felt like, to do anything. And they took their vacations without us, and I hated my family. And I just kind of went with that. And I wished I'd never been born. I remember really strongly feeling like that, that I didn't know why I'd been born. I wished I hadn't. Back east, we went ice skating. That's what we did on the weekends. We went to the mall sometimes, too, but ice skating was a really big thing that we did. It's where you start smoking cigarettes. It's where, like, the slow songs, you hope you'd go ask a guy to skate, and you just go around. But there was one really geeky ice skating song by Karen Carpenter, say it, that was I'll Say Goodbye to Love. And I just remember there was a line from that that said, no one ever cared if I should live or die. And that was the line that I identified with more than anything else when I was a kid. I just remember wishing I'd never been born, that I could just go to sleep and never wake up. And but I didn't act like that. Like, I was, like I said, I had a lot of friends, and but I was a liar. When I was in sixth grade, they had these school patrols with bright orange badges, and you just, I don't know, you stood at major street corners, and you just kind of put your arms out, and when the younger kids could cross, you went like, you just kind of motioned that it was okay for them to cross. And this flasher, like a raincoat flasher, was going around flashing the little girls' school patrols. And the police would come, and they would interview all the little girls who had been flashed. So I go running to school one day going, I was flashed, I was flashed. I was never flashed, okay? So I just wanted all the attention and everything else. And the police came, they interviewed me, and they caught the flasher. And he admitted to flashing everybody but me, because I'd never been flashed. No, I don't know where my parents were. I don't really remember my childhood much. And I don't have any idea where they were. And being a mom today, I can't even fathom, although I have to say, my daughter forged in first grade, I wouldn't get her out of PE, she forged a note to her first grade teacher saying, please excuse Molly Abrams from PE, you know, and it's phonetic because she's in first grade. The whole thing's phonetic, and it's signed Lauren Love, Lauren Abrams. I'm like, oh my God, I'm fucked. Oh, sorry. Sorry, I didn't mean to swear. Anyway, it's not Pacific Rim, what the hell. Anyway, so I was like, but she's so far so good. She's in 11th grade now and whatever. Anyway, but, you know, I mean, I'm just that kind of like, when I came in and I saw the ninth step on the banners, all I kept saying was, oh my God, does that mean we have to come clean on all our lives? I was running around. That's all I would say. It's like, just, does that mean we have to come clean on all our lives? Does that mean we have to come clean on all of us? That's all I kept thinking. I mean, I loved AA and I didn't understand. I earned my seat. There were a lot of things you guys said. The white flag at Radford, surrender. You have to surrender to win. Like, that was just too esoteric. I did not understand a lot of things, but I was running around. Does this ninth step mean you have to come clean on all your lives? And then this little old lady named Helen came up to me and she said, oh, honey, the steps are written in order for a reason. She said, besides, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, my whole family, including my husband, thought I only had one lung. And I was like, that's the kind of lying I did. Okay. And, oh, my God. I mean, I can remember somebody had arthroscopic surgery. And everybody went to the hospital. It wasn't. He had knee surgery. And anyway, and they wrapped it up, and everybody went and got him loaded and everything. So I went to the medical supply store and bought all the accoutrements and everything and wrapped up my knee. And anyway, like, I remember when I made my amends, my mom knew all my lies were lies except my knee. She actually thought I busted my knee playing football at the beach. I lived 3 hours from the beach. I never went to the beach. I never saw the sun until I got sober. And anyway, that was the only one she was so disappointed. And in fact, they didn't even want to hear my amends until I kept saying, no, no, I have to do this. She's like, no, no, you're sober. Everything's fine. I'm like, no, Mom. It was back and forth. No, no, it's okay. And I said, Mom, if you don't hear this, I could drink again. She said, sit down. Anyway, and so the steps work. But so anyway, I started stealing really young because a little girl showed me how I could take things and leave. And I think most little kids will think this is stealing, this is wrong. And I was like, oh, cool, something to get away with. That was just me. I think I'm just fundamentally that person from the gate. And I started getting arrested in fourth grade and sixth grade. I mean, arrested, you know, from the store, Montgomery Wards. I don't even know if they had it out here, but whatever. And it actually cured me of it in sixth grade. I was never, that was it. But, you know, this is all before I had my first drink. And I heard somebody else talking about this, and it was a relief to me when I heard somebody talking from the podium about being a liar, cheat, and thief before they ever had their first drink. And my first drink was a relief. I stole some J&B from my parents. I filled it up in a flask. I went out in the woods, because that's what you do back east. You go out in the woods, and I took a big old swig, and then and I hated the taste. Oh, my God. But then that feeling came over me. And I've heard a lot of women talk about how they became tall, blonde, and beautiful. That's not what happened for me. Suddenly that feeling came over me, and I didn't care what you thought of me. I didn't care what you thought of me. I didn't care about anything. I love the apathy, just not feeling. And I blacked out the first time I ever drank. I never heard the term blackout until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody who drank didn't remember. I just thought that was part of drinking. And thank God. I mean, I'm very happy with blackouts. And I got sick as could be, and I was just off to the races. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, people used to ask me if I had graduated high school, and I was just I was so offended by the question. I'm like, of course I graduated high school. I was very full of, like, the don't you know who I am, that whole alcoholic thinking we're better, pride and all that. You know, no matter how low I got, just the whole, don't you know who I am? And I love the saying, alcoholics are the only people that doesn't matter. I forgot it, but anyway, it'll come back. But thank God today I know who I am. I'm just another child of God, and I'm no better. I'm no worse than anyone else, and what a relief. But alcoholics are the only people who could be lying in the gutter looking down at others. And, and that was definitely me. It's the, you know, we're better than everyone, or we're the lowest of low. Nobody is worse than me. And it's just so much easier being in a worker among workers, one among others. But, so I was so offended that how could you ask me if I had graduated high school? I'm actually the first person in my family to not go to college. And I know we always hear everybody talk about getting sober and being the first one to ever go to college. I'm the first one in my family to not go to college because I just scammed my way through junior high and high school. I really have no recollection of being in class and studying and going to school. And I used to, my first couple years, have nightmares of not completing certain classes and not graduating and things like that. But I was always out in the woods. I was always with the partiers. And I just wrote, I wasn't a slick skipper. I just never went and I signed my own notes. I don't know. Anyway, my parents weren't going to send me to college and I was pissed and I was going to show them. And because I would go visit my older sister at school, and all I saw was the partying, the grain alcohol, and all the fun. And we would pile into my car back then. I've always worked. And we would go visit all the colleges, and we would just party every weekend. I couldn't believe my parents weren't going to send me. And all my friends went off to school. I got a job in sales right away, and Bill's story, which I just couldn't believe you guys wanted me to read this book. It was written in the 30s by a bunch of old men. What does this have to do with me? But in Bill's story, he talks about working and having reached a certain amount of accolades and achievement, and he felt like he had arrived. Well, I got a job in sales, and I set some national sales records, and I felt like I had arrived. I started making a lot of money. The drinking age in Maryland at that time was 18 for beer and wine, and you could drive into D.C. It was 18 for everything, and I discovered a lot of drugs, but this is Alcoholics Anonymous. I was taught that we keep our story to alcohol, but I was a garbage can. I was a total garbage can. I didn't care what you had. I just needed to know that you had enough of it if I was going to start. If you only had a little, there was some part of me that knew that, like, I couldn't start. Anyway, by the time I was 19, I was arrested in the town I grew up in, and I was allowed to make one phone call, and I had no one to call. I'd already used everyone up. My family wanted nothing to do with me. I'd already started having alcoholic seizures, grandma seizures, and I decided when I was in this jail cell, like, how dare you arrest me? Don't you know who I am? I was so full of myself, and I thought the problem is the kind of people I'd been hanging out with. If I quit hanging out with the kind of people I'd been hanging out with, a nice girl like me, get out of a situation like this, and these kinds of things won't happen. And never mind, I was all alone when I got arrested. I just thought it was the kind of people I'd been hanging out with, and I decided the problem was where I lived. And if you're new, it's called a geographic. And I decided to move to Miami. Not a good place to straighten up. That's just my experience. And so I went to Miami, and I got a job. I got a checking account because I was raised right. And I'm walking down the street, and some guy walking the other way said, "Hey, you want a party?" I'd never turned down a party in my life. I didn't know why I'd been born. I wished I hadn't. I just thought, I'm going to live hard and die young. My goal was to be dead at 25. And, of course, I went off partying with these people, never showed up for the job. And I started writing checks on these, just my starter checks. That's a big part of my story. If I had checks, I wrote them. And anyway, and I ended up down in the Keys, ripping off a few people I shouldn't have, and basically I bounced around this country. In some parts of the country, I ended up in jail, sometimes in the hospital. Even though my family wasn't speaking to me during this time, I'd make sure all the bills went to them because I wanted them to be really worried about me. I was the daughter from hell. And by the time I got to California, all I had left was one of those little nylon zip-up bags and my little nylon bags and my dog, and I slept in a abandoned house in North Hollywood on a dirt floor, and I still thought the problem was the kind of people I'd been hanging out with. A nice girl like me will get out of this. So I had nothing to do with anyone during this time. It was in North Hollywood where all these streets intersect, like Camarillo and Lancashire and, I don't know, all these streets intersect, and by a restaurant called Little Tony's. And I'm Jewish. I have Jewish hair. So there was electricity. I had to blow dry my hair. And it's very important. And it's all about the hair. And but I only had a piece of a mirror. And I can remember I would never look at my actual reflection, just my hair, because I couldn't stand who or what I'd become. And it's not my bottom. We're survivors. But during this time, I remember I called it my straight period. I only drank beer. And I would go to Little Tony's, and you could see, like, where the refrigerator would go in this place and stuff like that. But anyway, I would dry my hair, and I would do that. But I would go to Little Tony's, and I would write, "I will trust no one, I will trust no one, I will trust no one." My whole thing was, "I don't want you, I don't need you, leave me alone, and I'll be fine." And I ended up going on a date with this guy. I was working, selling clothes, and he took me out on a date, and it's one of those nights, some people relate to this and some don't. He took me to a bar on Melrose, And it's one of those nights where I was drinking, and I drank myself sober. And what a waste. And then he handed me a vial of cocaine, and I went in the bathroom, did the vial, gave him back his empty vial, and go, thanks, it's been a while. And I moved in with him the next day. And the next 2 years, I lived in a complete and total hell. It didn't matter how much I drank or used. I didn't get drunk. I just got weird. I was paranoid. I was hallucinating. I was out of my mind, crazy. And I didn't know about Alcoholics Anonymous. It never came up in conversation, not that I was a social butterfly. But if I thought of AA, which I didn't, I would have thought of a bunch of old men in trench coats with a bottle and a brown bag. And my bottom is so uneventful. If I had known it was my last drunk, maybe I would have done it up or something. But he ended up getting busted, and I had broken up with him before that. And I had kind of gotten my life a little bit more together. And I was living in this tiny apartment in the valley in Encino, which the area is really nice now, but it wasn't so nice back then. But I was living in this tiny apartment where the couch opened up into a bed. You could practically hit the wall. It had the fridge, the closet, that closet. I spent a lot of time in that closet. I used to have to toss everything, call the cops, you know, like, anyway, they were out there and just copying it. Anyway, it was just nuts. And the bathroom, and anyway, I was just sitting there reading a book one night, and I finished the book, and I have what we call in Alcoholics Anonymous my moment of clarity. It was like I was outside of myself looking down. And I knew at that moment that I was the worst person on the face of this earth. I knew nobody was as bad as me. Nobody had done the kinds of things I had done. Nobody had hurt people the way I had hurt people. Nobody had lied the way I had lied. And I wanted to die more than anything. And I couldn't even do that right. I had tried to kill myself a few weeks before that. And the only thing that happened was I'd lost muscle control on my body. And like I said, I'd never heard of AA. I called some 800 number that ended up being a hospital referral service. And this one place stayed on the phone with me all night, and it was Daniel Freeman Marina Hospital. And this guy I knew, he was from New York. He hotwired a car. I just figured everybody from New York probably knew how to hotwire a car. And he went and he dropped me off at Daniel Freeman Marina Hospital. He said, just be as honest as you can be. And this guy lived on Radford Street, and I was so scared of the alcoholics at the end of his street. And he told me he was an AA, but someone told him he could smoke pot to keep the edge off, and he smoked so much pot. And I used to tell him, you don't have to tell. I mean, good for you that, you know, you're in this AA, but you don't have to tell people. And anyway, so this is my perception. So I went and checked into this place, and I heard all this, like, religious stuff coming in. I don't think it's a religious-affiliated hospital, but this is what I heard. And then they started doing intake, and I started thinking, oh, my God, what if they're all narcs? So I started cutting down my intake, and they said, and we'll need a check as a deposit. I'm like, sure, no problem. How much? And anyway, like, the check was any good. Why places like that take checks from people like us? I'm sure they don't anymore, but they did back then. And and then, so we went through all this, and they said, would you like a Valium? I was like, yeah, sure. So they gave me one. I'm like, one. And they put me in a room, a detox room. I have no idea what it's called. And then there was nobody around at all. And this guy came in named Leroy, and he said, my name's Leroy. What are you here for? I go, what do you mean? He goes, cocaine, alcohol, heroin. I'm like, heroin? I'd never seen heroin. Anyway, and it was my first experience. We ended up talking. It was my first experience of one alcoholic talking to another. Can I tell you, his kid and my kid are in 11th grade together. They've been going to school together. We're still friends to this day. And that's a miracle. What happened was they took us to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm one of those people from my very first meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt like I had come home. I found out I wasn't a bad person. I'm a sick person. There's a way for me to get well. I heard somebody talking like I'm doing now, and I couldn't believe it. I never heard anybody talking like this in my whole life. What I heard was, and I was told that that I never had to drink again, one day at a time, if I didn't want to, and even if I want to, that I could just hang on, and I didn't have to do anything alone. What I heard was the music of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've kept coming back ever since then. That was June 12, 1986, so I've been sober for over 30 years. And just because I felt like I had come home does not mean that the obsession to drink and use left me. I wanted to get loaded all the time. I would go to meetings and hear somebody sharing about heroin, and I'd be like, oh, my God, I missed something. And nobody ever said, you are so sick, you need to leave. People were like, just keep coming back. just keep coming back. And people would love me till I could love myself. I was taught that I could do or be anything I want. The sky's the limit, as long as I don't drink or use one day at a time. And I never had any goals, dreams, or aspirations at all. Anything other than, like, be dead at 25. Like, that's not really one. Anyway, I was told that the sky's the limit, that we could still, and I can still do or be anything I want. And today I have a life that is absolutely beyond my imagination. I got a sponsor right away because everybody kept saying, do you have a sponsor? So I got a sponsor. And she had 3 years, and I just thought she had it. I remember when I turned three, I was like, do I have it? And all I knew is I felt really entrenched and part of Alcoholics Anonymous because I had been working the program and coming back and sponsoring, doing all the things you people told me. But I went and I asked her to be my sponsor, and she went through all these things. She said, I had to make my bed every day. I go, why? She says, so you don't get back in it. And then she went through all these different things, and no more blackout curtains. I was amazed she knew I had blackout curtains. She said, I have to open them every day and thank God for the privilege to breathe in and out clean and sober breaths. She didn't care if I believed in God or not. She told me to read the chapters of the agnostic until I could get a belief, and that I would get it through working the 12 steps, which is true. And she went through all these different things, to call her every day so I could get used to calling her, which is what I do with my sponsees. They call me every day for 90 days so they get used to it. And then she went through all this, and then she said, now you go find somebody with less time than you and tell her how you're staying sober. I said, but I'm staying sober because I'm in a rehab. She said, you could get loaded in there. I said, I can. And then I went and I found this girl with 3 days. I had 7 days of sobriety, and I said, hi, I'm Lauren. I have 7 days. And she said, hi, I'm whatever her name was. And she had 3 days. And when she started talking and I started listening, the magic of this program started for me. Because when she was talking and I was listening, I wasn't thinking about me. And what a relief. What a relief. And I started sponsoring really early on, and I've never stopped sponsoring. I've never stopped coming to meetings. I have always had commitments at meetings. The Nitty Gritty Women's Discussion is my home group. I've been going there since 1986. I am there every Monday night. And so I was taught I could do or be anything I want, anything at all, the sky's the limit. At 5 months of sobriety, my utilities and phone were turned off. There weren't cell phones then. And I was getting dressed to go drink. I didn't know why I was staying sober. I was so miserable. And I walked by a payphone, which really dates me. My kids thought they were really cool when we were traveling. And I called a girl in the program, and I told her what I was doing. She goes, where are you? And she came and got me, and she took me the last 15 minutes of a meeting. Then she took me to get something to eat, and then she took me home. And that night I knew that you guys would go to hell with me and back to help me stay sober, and if I want a drink, there's the door. And that night I decided I was staying sober till I had a year of sobriety, and then I'm out of here. But I wanted a cake. And my sponsor lent me money to get my utilities turned back on, and she told me that I could pass that on in the future. And then she said, self-supporting through our own contributions, Lauren, includes you. Quit hanging out with the terminally unemployed at Bradford's noon meetings and go get a job. So I went and got a job waiting tables, which I thought was so beneath me. Don't you know who I am? That whole, like, thing. She said I had to keep that job till I had a year of sobriety. At a year and 1 day of sobriety, I quit that job because I had saved up enough money to get a car. And I was able to get back in sales. And from one sales job, I got a little bit better sales job. And at 3 years of sobriety, I had started a little company with somebody else in the program, and it was going under. And I had a thing in my car that said, God never gave us a dream without giving us the strength to carry it out. I flew back east to visit my family, and they said, because I made amends, I could do things like that. And they said, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to go to college. And I always thought, I'm the dumb one in my family. I burned out way too many brain cells. I don't know how to do it. I can't ever remember anything. But you people have taught me how to do this. So I went to Pierce College in the Valley, and there's a big sign there that says information. I used to have to know everything, but it's way faster just to ask people. I went to where it says information, and I said, I want to go to school. What do I do? And they taught me how to do it. And those of you who have done school in sobriety, you said you do it like you do meetings. So I went to class. What a concept. And I started with just one class. I now know it was a terrible teacher, but it was a sociology class, and I thought the subject was really fascinating, and I would go, and I'd read a paragraph, I'd get to the next paragraph, I already forgot the first paragraph, I'm like, I'm too stupid, and I can't do this, and then I was taught that the brain is a muscle, and it just needs some exercise, it hadn't atrophied, and anyway, I started going there all the time, and I started working for the nicest man in the world, doing some sales, and after I was there for a while, had to look for where I wanted to transfer to, and I decided I wanted to go to UCLA because we had a good football team at the time. I know, outside issue. And anyway, and I decided I wanted to be a communications major because I liked all the stuff listed under it. And then I found out the communications major at UCLA only takes 100 people a year and 25 from outside of UCLA. When I was looking for another major, somebody in the program said to me, they take 25 people a year from outside of UCLA? And I said, yeah. And he said, why not you? And I never would have thought of that. 1994, I graduated as a communications major from UCLA, and so many of you came to support me, and I got to speak at the graduation. And in 1997, I graduated from USC Law School, and in December of 1997, I got sworn into the bar for the state of California. And then I got married in the program, and I have two of the greatest kids in the world. And I'm the luckiest person I know, hands down. Because you don't get from where I was, this falling down, wanting to die, hopeless alcoholic, to a woman who stands before you today with so many friends, this great boyfriend who I've purposely not looking at because it's the first time he's hearing my story and he knew none of this. None. He only knows the person I am today, which I reminded him of last night. when he said, good news, my business meeting canceled. It's like, oh. Yay. But you don't get from where I was to where I am today, a person of grace, dignity, and self-respect, with a life beyond my wildest dreams. But we do. We get this all the time. Like the speaker I'm sure that Matt had last week and that he'll have next week. This is what we get. This is what and who we are. This is the 12 steps in action. And I mean, this is just till today, till now, that my life. It keeps getting better and better and better and fuller and fuller and fuller. And my kids know that they have a sober mom to come home to. They don't really know what that is, but I'll come home to meetings where I hear something and go, you're so lucky. They have no idea. But I'm just so incredibly grateful for my life, and I want to thank you for asking me to speak, and so now I will take questions. Question is, standard old question, does the ability to limit our shares to alcohol limit our ability to reach newcomers not being able to talk about drugs? Is that okay? And I have to say the meeting that they held at Daniel Freeman Hospital, the AA meeting there, became, this is in 1986, got taken out of the directory because too many addicts were sharing. This is certainly not new. And unfortunately, they made me a treasurer at that time. And the meeting just kept collecting money. And like I said, my utilities were turned off. So anyway, I had to make amends to that meeting. Anyway, yeah. You know, we get better in increments. And, you know, every meeting is its own meeting. It's so not a new topic. I think every single person who was up here would give you a different answer. As Matt said when he introduced me, nobody is an authority, which is what's so great about AA. Nobody's in charge here. If you're new and you meet somebody and they say they're in charge, run. Nobody is in charge here. It's an incredible thing. It's an inverse triangle because that's the truth. And, you know, we share our experience, strength, and hope one-on-one, but I was taught from the podium, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said I was a garbage can, which I guess I was. I have no idea. Probably most of the stuff that I never had a wine cooler. That's an alcohol drink, so I got sober before those. I mean, we could do that in many forms.
I'm just curious, how was your experience today while you were in college?
He wants to know how my experience was as an undergrad and in law school, and did I help other undergrads get sober? I don't think so. But what I think I am is an example that anybody can go back to school and that we can do anything and we can achieve anything at any time. And I am such a cheerleader for anybody getting education at any point. I went to meetings on campus at UCLA, and there's people here that I went to meetings with from there, and they're small and they're great. But I don't know that I helped any undergrads get sober. I'm a lot quieter than some people. It's something I'm working on about my sobriety. I mean, one time I got somebody out of jury duty when they were in a jury pool, but that was it. You know. Peggy?
Thanks, Lauren. How and when did you handle that lying problem?
The question is, how and when did I handle that lying problem? That is a collective effort, but I have to say it's so funny as a mom. We don't lie in our family, but we don't, or we try not to. And today I think I could probably be lied to because I first, you know, it's the cash register, honestly, but I had the perfect sponsor. I really think my higher power puts a perfect person in my life at the right time. My sponsor every single day when I called her said, "Did you lie today, Lauren?" Every single day. And I would tell her. She was the one person I could tell the truth to. And it got to where, after a while, she said, "Okay, now go tell that person you lied to them." And it was a slow thing. Or after meetings, we would all go out and get something to eat, and it was the fellowship. And everybody would be talking, and then I remember one time going out and saying, "Oh, you know what? That was a lie." And somebody else would go, "Mine was too." And everybody was like, "We're all liars." And through working the steps and the lies that just really ate me up, I came clean on every single one of those. And I have no secrets today. None. Not one. I am an open book. My sponsor's here. I love my sponsor. And she knows everything. I have no lies at all from my boyfriend, which is really cool. You know, I mean, it's really an incredible thing. And I ask every day for God to give me an open heart and an open mind. I don't even have to pray for honesty anymore the way I did. I mean, before I was like, "God, please keep me honest today." But I think the steps really, really address it well. The question is that when I came in, I had problems with the whole God thing. Have I dealt with it or did it change? You know, what was interesting is when I was in rehab, before I went to my first meeting, one of the doctors said, and I thought this was just for me because I'm special and because I'm Jewish, that he said, "They're going to take you to these meetings and they're going to talk about a higher power. You should use the group for higher power." Do you know, it was over a year before I knew it was in the literature. I thought I was using the group because I was Jewish. Like, what the hell? And so I would use the group. But there was also a man there named Spence who would talk to me about it at length, and he was so spiritual, and he would say, "Do you believe that I believe in God?" I said, "Oh, yeah, you totally do." And he lent me his higher power. I couldn't believe it. Somebody would lend me something. Me. And I just, it was absolutely blew me away. And it's something that I've, of course, did over the years. And I had the educational variety spiritual experience at first that the big book talks about through working the 12 steps. I had an educational variety spiritual experience. And over the years, it has certainly expanded to, I mean, I meditate now on a daily basis. And I went to a place in Arizona a number of years ago, and I went to a meditation thing, and the guy, and I went up and asked for instruction, and the guy there, and I told him I was in the program, and he goes, "What is it with you 12-steppers that you don't do your 11th step?" And he gave me this flash drive with the greatest instructional meditation stuff on it. And it really, really opened the doorway for me. And I love the spiritual practice, but it's very, really sets it out well just in the big book in the 12 and 12. And it suggests using the 11-step prayer. So... The question is, do I leave out the first part about lawyer and liar? Yeah. I almost escaped the question, right? The question is, if I encountered my old self right now, what would I tell my old self? You don't have to live like this anymore. I mean, hands down, you don't have to. There's a way out. I mean, I had no idea. When I came in and I found this, I mean, I am one of those people from my first meeting. I felt like I had come home. So I would go to those dark Naga-high bars in the valley and go, you don't have to do this. You can go to AA. It's free. And I would tell, I just figured, since I didn't know, nobody knew. And I did that quite a few times. And my sponsor was like, no, it's a program of attraction, not promotion. You do not need to be running around telling people these. Anyways, because that was me. Like, you don't have to. And so I would absolutely, but you can't, I mean, it's for people that want it, unfortunately, but I would absolutely tell myself that. A little bit. You're asking, does it get easier? Or does the obsession go away? Is that what? Yeah. Are you asking me to quantify how long till your obsession goes away? Yeah. I think it's individual. I kept feeling like I did something wrong because everybody else, I came in and the obsession went away. And I think that's why I had so much trouble with, everyone kept telling me, you have to surrender. You haven't surrendered if you're still having the obsession. I have no idea to this day if I didn't surrender or was I not willing. I have no clue. All I know is I wanted to get loaded a lot and I would hold on. For the next 5 minutes, I'm not getting loaded. And I would do that. And I would call people and tell them. I was told my head is Station K, you know. I won't swear, and that I needed to change the station, and I had to call other people to tell them that I wanted to. Don't let it grow and fester in my head. I think my sponsor got sick of me calling her, telling her I wanted to get loaded, and she said, well, maybe, Lauren, that's what you need to do. And what I heard was my sponsor gave me permission to get loaded, so I called somebody else, and they said, for you, it's not an option. So I made the sign, for me, it's not an option. Like anything, whatever you can do to just not drink between now and when we go to sleep tonight. And then in the morning, every day, it's Pavlovian for me at this point. The first thought is, God, please keep me sober today. And my last thought is, thank you. It's always, it's just that simple. And when I start to confuse it, and it's the same. You can ask anybody with time. It's the same thing. God, please keep me sober today. Thank you at night. Go to meetings. Work with others. Make the phone calls and work the stuff. I mean, it's the same exact formula, and it's the foundation in the first year. So I can't tell you when you're not going to, but we just don't between now and when we go to sleep tonight. And then, I mean, the gratitude of not having that obsession is incredible. So, hey. Do I what?
Talk about your service in AA. How you are of service.
She's asking how I'm of service in AA. I think I've done most every form of service. Some I like more than others, but I've always sponsored women. I just always have. There were times when I was studying for the bar, or when I was going to have my kids and things like that, when I would call my sponsor and go, how am I going to do this? And she said, it'll work out. Like, she's just so calm and soothing. And she'd tell me, do what I need to do to keep my strength up. And it just does. I even though I may sponsor a lot of women, everybody isn't in the muck at the same time. Everybody, just the universe seems to make everything work. Everything always works out. If you're on my gratitude list, you know that is my mantra. Everything always works out. It just always does. As long as I don't drink and use one day at a time and I do the footwork, it just always works out. And I don't know how that is. I just know it does. I've done the phones at central office. I've done GSR. I've always got a meeting commitments. Always, always, always. And I never want to go. I started a meeting, which there's people from that meeting today. And I love my Thursday meeting. I started it, probably 8 years ago at 1 o'clock because there wasn't a convenient 1 o'clock meeting. I like to be home with my kids at night is why I started it. And I go at night on Mondays, but I've been going to a lot of daytime meetings. There's always noon meetings. I needed a 1 o'clock convenient meeting, so I started one. And it's a great meeting. You can always start a meeting. They always say coffee pot and a resentment will start a meeting. You can start it without that too. And I love my 1 o'clock Thursday meeting. It's so great. And that's another way to be of service. So I love AA. I was taught that from somebody who used to come to my Monday night meeting that Alcoholics Anonymous is the first domino. If that goes, everything else in my whole life, the rest goes too. So I need to take care of this first. Nadine. To survive what? To survive the hard relationships that we have? In the rooms. The question is, how do we survive the hard relationships that we have in the rooms? We just don't drink and we don't use no matter what, and everything passes. It just does. And everything, the toughest things that we go through are where we get the most spiritual growth. I wouldn't get to where I am today if I hadn't gone through everything I've gone through. And I know that without a doubt, that I'm in the place I'm at today because of everything I've gone through. And I wouldn't change it. I got to have the experiences that I've had to get here. And I've stayed sober through all of them, and I've grown spiritually through all of them. Absolutely. So... thank you.